I had decided to go for a drive, and when we started, the sun was shining brightly in Munich. Just as we were about to depart, Herr Delbruck, the maître d'hôtel of the Quatre Saisons, where I was staying, came down bareheaded to the carriage and said to the coachman, "Remember, you are back by nightfall. You know what night it is." Johann answered with an emphatic, "Ja, mein Herr." When we had cleared the town, I said, after signalling to him to stop, "Tell me, Johann, what is tonight?" He crossed himself as he answered laconically, "Walpurgisnacht." He started off rapidly, as if to make up for lost time. The road was pretty bleak, for we were traversing a sort of high, wind-swept plateau. As we drove, I saw a road which seemed to dip through a little winding valley. It looked so inviting that I called Johann to stop and told him I would like to drive down that road. He made all sorts of excuses and frequently crossed himself as he spoke. Finally, I said, "Well, Johann, I want to go down this road. I shall not ask you to come unless you like, but tell me why you do not like to go. That is all I ask." For answer, he stretched out his hands appealingly to me and implored me not to go. I tried to argue with him, but it was difficult to argue with a man when I did not know his language. Whilst we were talking, we heard a sort of sound between a yelp and a bark. It was far away, but the horses got very restless, and it took Johann all his time to quiet them. He was pale and said, "It sounds like a wolf, but there are no wolves here now." Whilst he was petting the horses and trying to quiet them, dark clouds drifted rapidly across the sky. Johann looked under his lifted hand at the horizon and said, "The storm of snow. He comes before a long time." Then he looked at his watch again and climbed to his box as though the time had come for proceeding on our journey. "Tell me," I said, "about this place where the road leads." "It is unholy." "What is unholy?" "The village." "Then there is a village." "No, no. No one lives there hundreds of years." "But you said there was a village."
"There was."
"Where is it now?" Whereupon he burst out into a long story in German and English. Roughly, I gathered that long ago, hundreds of years, men had died there and been buried in their graves. And sounds were heard under the clay. And when the graves were opened, men and women were found rosy with life, and their mouths red with blood. And so those who were left fled away to other places, where the living lived and the dead were dead, and not something. He was evidently afraid to speak the last words. Finally, in an agony of desperation, he cried, "Walpurgisnacht," and pointed to the carriage for me to get in. I took my oak walking stick, which I always carry on my holiday excursions, and pointing back to Munich said, "Go home, Johann. Walpurgis night does not concern Englishmen." With a despairing gesture, Johann turned his horses towards Munich. He went slowly along the road for a while. Then there came over the crest of the hill a man, tall and thin. When he drew near the horses, they began to jump and kick about, then to scream with terror. Johann could not hold them in. They bolted down the road, running away madly. I watched them out of sight, then looked for the stranger, but I found that he too was gone. With a light heart, I turned down the side road. I took little heed of time, and it was only when the deepening twilight forced itself upon me that I began to think of how I should find my way home. The brightness of the day had gone. The air was cold, and the drifting of clouds high overhead was more marked. They were accompanied by a sort of faraway rushing sound, through which seemed to come at intervals that mysterious cry which the driver had said came from a wolf. For a while I hesitated. I had said I would see the deserted village, so on I went, and presently came on a wide stretch of open country, shut in by hills all around. As I looked, there came a cold shiver in the air, and the snow began to fall. The wind grew stronger and blew with ever-increasing force, till I was fain to run before it. Every now and then the heavens were torn asunder by vivid lightning, and in the flashes I could see ahead of me a great mass of trees, chiefly yew and cypresses, all heavily coated with snow. I was soon amongst the shelter of the trees. By and by, the storm seemed to be passing away. It now only came in fierce puffs or blasts. At such moments, the weird sound of the wolf appeared to be echoed by many similar sounds around me. As the snow had ceased to fall, I walked out from the shelter and began to investigate more closely. As I skirted the edge of the copse, I found that a low wall encircled it, and following this, I presently found an opening. Here, the cypresses formed an alley leading up to a square mass of some kind of building. Suddenly, the moonlight broke through the clouds, showing me that I was in a graveyard, and that the square object before me was a great massive tomb of marble, as white as the snow that lay on and all around it. I walked around it and read, over the Doric door in German, Countess Dolingen of Graz, in Styria, sought and found death, 1801. On the top of the tomb, seemingly driven through the solid marble, was a great iron spike or stake. On going to the back, I saw, graven in great Russian letters, "The dead travel fast." I began to wish for the first time that I had taken Johann's advice. Here a thought struck me. This was Walpurgis night. Walpurgis night, when, according to the belief of millions of people, the devil was abroad. When the graves were opened and the dead came forth and walked. This was the depopulated village of centuries ago. This was where the suicide lay. And this was the place where I was alone, shivering with cold in a shroud of snow, with a wild storm gathering again upon me. And now a perfect tornado burst upon me, hailstones that beat down leaf and branch and made the shelter of the cypresses useless. I was soon fain to seek the only spot that seemed to afford refuge, the deep Doric doorway of the marble tomb. As I leaned against the door, it moved slightly and opened inwards. I was about to enter it when there came a flash of forked lightning. In the instant I saw, as my eyes were turned into the darkness of the tomb, a beautiful woman with rounded cheeks and red lips, seemingly sleeping on a bier. As the thunder broke overhead, I was grasped as by the hand of a giant and hurled out into the storm. Just then there came another blinding flash, which seemed to strike the iron stake that surmounted the tomb and to pour through to the earth, blasting and crumbling the marble as in a burst of flame. The dead woman rose for a moment of agony while she was lapped in the flame, and her bitter scream of pain was drowned in the thunder crash. The last thing I heard was the howling of wolves. The last sight that I remembered was a vague, white, moving mass, as if all the graves around me had sent out the phantoms of their sheeted dead, and that they were closing in on me through the white cloudiness of the driving hail. Gradually, there came a sort of vague beginning of consciousness, then a sense of weariness. That was dreadful. My feet seemed positively racked with pain, yet I could not move them. Some heavy weight on my chest made it difficult for me to breathe. A vast stillness enveloped me, as though all the world were asleep or dead, only broken by the low panting as of some animal close to me. I felt a warm rasping at my throat. Then came a consciousness of the awful truth. Some great animal was lying on me and now licking my throat. Through my eyelashes, I saw above me the two great flaming eyes of a gigantic wolf. Its sharp white teeth gleamed in the gaping red mouth, and I could feel its hot breath fierce and acrid upon me. For another spell of time, I remembered no more. Then I became conscious of a low growl, followed by a yelp, renewed again and again. Then, seemingly far away, I heard a, "Hello! Hello!" as of many voices calling in unison. As the voices drew closer, the wolf yelped faster and louder. I feared to make either sound or motion. Then, all at once, from beyond the trees, there came, at a trot, a troop of horsemen bearing torches. The wolf rose from my breast and made for the cemetery. I saw one of the horsemen raise his carbine and take aim. A companion knocked up his arm, and I heard the ball whiz over my head. He had evidently taken my body for that of the wolf. Then, at a gallop, the troop rode forward, some towards me, others following the wolf as it disappeared among the snow-clad cypresses. Two or three of the soldiers jumped from their horses and knelt beside me. One of them raised my head and placed his hand over my heart. "Good news, comrades," he cried. "His heart still beats." Then some brandy was poured down my throat. Lights and shadows were moving among the trees, and I heard men call to one another. And the lights flashed as the others came pouring out of the cemetery, pell-mell, like men possessed. When the further ones came close to us, those who were around me asked them eagerly, "Well, have you found it?" The reply rang out hurriedly, "No, no, come away, quick. This is no place to stay, and on this of all nights." The officer looked at my throat and said, "He's all right. The skin is not pierced. We should never have found him but for the yelping of that wolf." "What became of it?" asked the man who was holding up my head. "It went to its home," answered a man who actually shook with terror as he glanced around him fearfully. "There are graves enough there in which it may lie." The officer told the men to say nothing of what they had seen, except that they had found an English stranger guarded by a large dog. "Dog? That was no dog," cut in the man who had exhibited such fear. "I think I know a wolf when I see one." "A dog, as I said. If aught else was said, we should only be laughed at." I was then mounted behind a trooper, and we rode back to Munich. When we arrived, Herr Delbruck rushed so quickly down the steps to meet me that it was apparent he had been watching within. Taking me by both hands, he solicitously led me in. The officer saluted me and was turning to withdraw when I recognised his purpose and insisted that he should come to my rooms. Over a glass of wine, I warmly thanked him and his brave comrades for saving me. "But, Herr Delbruck, how did you know I was lost?" I asked. "The driver came hither with the remains of his carriage, which had been upset when the horses ran away. But surely you would not send a search party of soldiers merely on this account." "Oh, no," he answered. "But even before the coachman arrived, I had this telegram from the nobleman whose guest you are." And he took from his pocket a telegram which he handed to me, and I read. "Be careful of my guest. His safety is most precious to me. Should aught happen to him, or if he be missed, spare nothing to find him and ensure his safety. He is English and therefore adventurous. There are often dangers from snow and wolves and night. Lose not a moment if you suspect harm to him. I answer your zeal with my fortune." As I held the telegram in my hand, the room seemed to whirl around me. And if the attentive maitre d'hotel had not caught me, I think I should have fallen. I was certainly under some form of mysterious protection. I looked back at the telegram. At the bottom was the name Dracula.